Hello and welcome to Get Jill, Get Chicken Bones. A common misconception amongst my peers is that I know a lot of stuff or that I have the answers to questions that span a whole cross-section of life as they shout, Get Jill! Full disclosure, people, I don't. In this series of podcasts, I'll be discussing topics surrounding the mind and the body that affect us modern souls. Hopefully coming out the other side, pulling up our big know-it-all pants just a little higher each time. Let's get to the chicken bones of it. Okay, up this week we're talking all things yoga. Now, yoga's a bit marmite, a love, hate, or a meh, I'm not bothered about it. Just as running isn't for everyone, is yoga for everyone? Today I want to explore the benefits and dispel the myths surrounding all things yoga related. Let's start with a big intro and welcome Lisa McCabe from Om Shanti Yoga Living and Optimal Health and Wellbeing. Lisa's been a yoga teacher for 14 years and practicing a whole lot longer. Lisa's a yoga therapeutic specialist, having trained with yoga medicine for over 5 years. Even although she teaches yoga, she still terms herself as a yoga student, always learning. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi.
Now, have I over-delivered on that intro there? I've given you the big up, haven't I?
Well. Just a touch. But no, thank you for having me. And yes, that was a bit of a big up.
But yeah, you are still a student.
I am. Oh, very much. Still learning. To
it
the point
ends.
Of even yesterday, still learning.
Great.
Fortunately for me, yoga is something that you never know enough of. And
oh,
you can
fantastic.
Keep exploring it,
so we can so. Pick your brains today.
Yeah.
Now, yoga is said to be the panacea for the mind, body and spirit. Although they're inextricably linked, I'm going to try and break those three areas down today.
Mm-hmm.
But first, let's start with the views of others. Not so much now as yoga enters the mainstream at a rate of knots, but there's still some outdated ideas out there about yoga. Essentially, do you have to be a chilled out hippie to be doing yoga? Should I be wearing tight fisherman pants?
Well, your choice of clothing is down to you, and you would be most welcome in tight fisherman pants. But no, you absolutely don't. But absolutely, I can totally. I lived those years as a very young yoga student where, you know, as soon as you mentioned, oh, I do yoga, they're like, oh, God. Here she comes, the hippie trippy.
Yeah.
Chanting
wearing bead wearing.
Bead wearing. Yeah, everything fits the bill. But actually, that connotation weirdly came about probably before then, but the Beatles made it quite a popular association with being a hippie and yoga, because when they went off to Rishikesh, they were recording an album and they stayed in an ashram. And I actually went there, and these little huts that they lived in looked like sort of ant mounds, and you see it all over the place that the Beatles were there. But obviously I think more well known is the fact that it was George Harrison, and that connotation came because it was, you know, in the 60s, and
yeah.
That's when, you know, it was
love,
free love
peace.
And all that kind of stuff,
yeah.
And the Beatles obviously started doing yoga. They were actually doing transcendental meditation, with meditation being part of yoga. So that's where that sort of association came about, I feel, anyway.
Yeah.
And we got kind of labelled with that for a long, long time. And still people say to me, oh, yeah, you must be a well-chilled out hippie. But you're like, no, you don't. And you actually
still
don't
get uptight now. Yeah.
Yeah. But actually nowadays, obviously the way that yoga has been brought into the Western world and how we've evolved it, it's very much open to anyone and everyone, most certainly. But unfortunately, where we had the hippie stigma back in the 60s, we've now got the Instagram stigma of what people see in imagery, where they feel they've got to be this certain type of person to be able to do it,
yeah.
Which they absolutely do not need to be.
Yeah, get into certain poses,
yeah.
And whatnot. So this is a loaded one, but is yoga a religion?
No.
Now, I have seen this online,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I've heard people ask it.
Yeah. Oh, I was. I think I told you, I got refused. Years and years ago, I was trying to find a hall. This was way before social media and all that. This is like going back into the, early 2000s. And I was trying to find a space to teach. And I phoned up a church hall in the island, and they said I couldn't teach there because yoga is a religion and it conflicts with the Christian religion. And there was no possible
wow.
way they would allow me. And I was sort of on the phone, like taken aback, thinking, hang on a minute, you know, in all my years of, you know, this is not. And the reason why it's confused is because a lot of the ancient texts are based on Hindu religion.
Right.
And yoga has been built from that. So you will find a lot of reference to Hinduism within the traditional yoga texts. And in obviously, for those people practicing Hinduism, it forms a big part of their way of life.
Yeah.
One of my very good friends, she's Hindi, and she is, I'm going to say, probably one of the best mindfulness teachers out there. But she blends her traditions into her practice. And obviously, we know yoga came from India, and India's got one of the most beautifully blended, you know, communities in the whole wide world, where yeah. you've got many people.
And a lot of them
are
Christian as well.
No, not at all. You mean you've got so many different religions, Sikhs, yeah. Muslims, Hindus, you know, Buddhists, all living yeah. and, you know, working together and practicing these very traditional, you know, things, these very traditional practices that form their way of life.
Yeah.
So I think for me, over the years of studying, and I've been asked that question so many times, the confusion is when we start looking at the philosophy, there's references to various different things, which makes people feel like it is a religion, but it isn't.
It's not.
We follow Buddhist texts, we follow Hindu texts,
yeah.
we follow all sorts.
That leads me on to the language. What does namaste actually mean?
Okay, so namaste is a greeting that if you go into a yoga class, and not every teacher uses it, but if you go into a yoga class, you might be greeted by the teacher with the words namaste, and quite often the class will end with the same greeting. In India, every day, if you're walking down the street, you will be greeted by every single person will come out on the street and welcome you with namaste. And essentially, so the language that we use in yoga is Sanskrit. And the Sanskrit meaning of namaste is nama means to bow, and as means I, and ti means you. So it's essentially saying I bow to you. So normally, traditionally, the way it would be student to teacher and teacher to student. So the teacher is respecting the student, and the student is very much respecting the teacher. And if we evolve that even more, I prefer the translation of the light I see in me is the light I see in you. So it's an acknowledgement of each other.
Yeah.
And I guess you could say it's a welcoming. It's a greet.
It's just a little bit of respect.
But it's just showing the acknowledgement that you are aware of each other's presence.
Yeah. Nice. So getting on to the body and the postures, I'm going to go into this section now, and the actual movement of yoga. In terms of the postures, do we all have to be flexible? That's one of the things I hear. Oh, I'm not going to yoga. I can't even touch my toes. Is that necessary?
No. I hear this all the time and it really makes me laugh. I'm like, actually, if you can't touch your toes, please come to my class because I really want to see you. The thing is, I mean, and it's quite interesting because obviously now, like especially through my yoga medicine training, where we're trained specifically on orthopedics. So, we look a lot, you know, I spent lots of hours studying the hip, the spine, the shoulder.
So orthopedics in terms of how your bones
so
move,
orthopedics as in looking at the joints. So looking at the hip joint specifically, the shoulder joint specifically, and then the actual spine itself, and understanding the function together with the dysfunction of those joints. So the most common thing you will see in yoga when people look at it and assume flexibility is the fact that people will look at imagery of people in very advanced poses.
Yeah.
Now, within the body, we've got a normal range of movement. So we are designed to move our joints within a certain range. So there's a certain degree of movement that our joints are designed to do. Now, if somebody has hypermobility, their range of movement is above average. So they will be able to get into certain poses such as Padmasana. So the most common one associated with yoga, that lotus pose.
Oh, your legs are crossed. And
yeah, where your legs are crossed
underneath.
Or they might see somebody with one, you know, half handstand where one leg looks like they're in the splits in the air.
Yeah.
So we call those people hypermobile. Now, actually, for us as teachers, particularly for me as a yoga therapist, that person to me is actually the most risky student that will be in my class because there is no stability around their joints. So for me, it's a case of trying to hold them back from going to that end range of movement because for them, obviously they're straining their ligaments. There's a lot of well, we'd have to have a look at individual cases, actually, to generalise to say the length of their muscle tissue could be longer. I don't know if that's possible, but there's going to be a lot of more hyper movement, which is not something that you want to take into later life, particularly as women, because of obviously osteoarthritis, all those kinds of things. Yeah. So for joint health, being really flexible is actually could be quite hindering.
Right.
So actually coming with a bit of stiffness, where we are looking at tension, so we might be wanting to make somebody a bit more flexible.
It could actually be a good thing.
Well, it is a good thing because they've got some stability around the joint, even if it's just really tight. Yeah. And then it also leads on to, you know, what they discuss more in yin yoga, which is tension and compression. So it might not be that somebody's really stiff. It could be that there is compression within that joint. And that's what we mean is where bone meets bone.
Right.
And compression actually can be talked about in other ways. But just for simplistic terms, if we're looking at flexibility, some poses will not be achievable by a lot of people just because of the way their bones are structured and where the joints fit. But yeah, it's an annoying one as a teacher because it deters people from coming because there's this false sense of I have to be flexible to be able to do it, when in actual fact, you really, really don't.
Yeah.
And now science, as we're studying it, we're learning as the more research goes on that the muscle tissue isn't necessarily what we're stretching. It's more about the connective tissue that encases the muscle tissue.
Oh, so that leads me on to, so if you're doing any home practice, I mean, during these times, is it possible to do yoga wrong?
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness.
So say you just think, oh, I don't want to go to a class. I'm a bit embarrassed. Can't touch my toes, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to do one of these online things.
Yeah.
I've got a mat. Let's crack it out.
Yeah. And this is the worrying thing. When I was chatting to Tony about this, we were talking about how, you know, through the lockdown, everybody's had to go to an online presence. Mm. And our sort of... we're not regulated, but we have a sort of body that supports us that we can be members of. And they were amazing when we came into lockdown about how you go online safely. And obviously people are at their own risk. We've lost the ability for the teacher to be able to observe.
Yeah. And
we've lost the ability.
I'm a huge fan of being adjusted.
Yeah.
I like the teacher touching me, but that is so... The teacher doesn't even come near you now.
And... you know, we've got the thing is with yoga as well, it depends if there's for teachers, it's hard because online you're demonstrating a lot more than you probably would if you were in a studio setting.
Yeah.
And obviously as a teacher, you've got an established self-practice. You're an experienced yogi. So you are going to look very different to what the person at home is going to look like. So there's going to be an element of, well, why don't I look like that?
Yeah,
especially if they're a beginner.
Am I doing this right? Is my leg in the right place?
Yeah, why is her leg there and mine isn't? But then that leads back to your other question of flexibility. Well, it could just be because your body is completely different.
Yeah, it's not designed to do that.
So it's not, you know, you're going to be very different to the person next to you. Mm. Whereas in class, that can be really managed quite easily because you can give people props.
Yeah.
You can put them into positions. You can offer light adjustments. You're cueing your verbal instruction is much clearer because as an experienced teacher, you will be able to see when somebody needs a bit more support. Whereas online, I know some of my peers, they've limited classes so they can see everybody.
Oh, yeah. So you log in, the teacher can see you.
Yeah, the teacher can see
you.
Yeah. But if you're just logging on to, say, for example, just a random YouTube video that's pre-recorded, then you obviously haven't got that comfort either. So, yeah, to go back to your question, absolutely. You've got to be super careful.
You can do it wrong.
Respect your limitations.
You could injure yourself.
You can. Like with anything. I mean, even following Bless P with Joe got a big bit of stick because so many people got injured from, you know, following him. But, you know, the guy is, you know, as with all of us that have, you know, that have gone online, if you're going to go out to the masses, people have to take responsibility. So
yeah, sure, you've got to take responsibility for yourself.
Yeah, but be careful.
Yeah. Before one last thing on the body itself, can we be clear here that we don't have to be 100% clean living?
Absolutely.
No chips, no alcohol.
No.
I mean, I've got to be all kale juice.
No. I like, it's really funny because it reminds me of when I first first got into it, when I was really young, I was only 17, and you know, it was like everything by the book. And even back then, you know, I'm going back to the 90s, so it was very much that association. You can't do anything. If you're going to practice yoga, this is this clean living, you know. It's a bit like the Buddhist monks when they go and they say they're going to be a Buddhist monk, they abstain for everything. And don't get me wrong, I did experience a few areas of abstinence where it was like, I'm not going to do this and I'm not going to do that. But as you evolve and you become more confident in your practice and you start to learn a lot more about yoga in itself that goes beyond the practice, there's areas of your life that, yes, you do, you know, having a drink every now and again and giving into a bit of chocolate isn't going to put you on the road to yoga hell type thing. You know, it's like it's all about balance.
Of course,
and it, you know, everything,
everybody knows you can't do anything on a hangover anyway. No. So,
but you know, it, you know, on the flip side of that, we see the benefits of yoga where we're helping former addicts come through addiction with the help of yoga. You know, so you definitely don't have to be as pure as back, you know, historically. And again, that's kind of associated to the fact that traditionally it was swamis. We call them swamis, or, you know, guru. You use that term very, very loosely. But the swamis of India, where the guys would normally be sort of in their ashrams or whatever, and they didn't, you know, they didn't drink. They didn't, obviously, they didn't have alcohol. You can still, there's areas in India where you still can't get alcohol. Well, you don't, because they're vegetarian, or, you know, those are the particular states. But, and they will still live that kind of life. And yes, you know, if you're living in an ashram style environment, you will very much be as pure as they want you to be, because purity is part of the eight.
But
limbs.
In the Western
but
terms.
In this real world, and that is the operative word, it's the real world. Yeah. Of course, you're going to have a coffee. You're going to have, you know, we're going to have whatever you want. And that doesn't make you a bad yogi. So.
And just touching, I know I'm going down a rabbit hole here, but how, I've read so many things about how long you should leave it before you eat. When you eat before a class, some people say you eat up to 4 hours before and don't eat anything else before a class. Are you quite flexible with that?
Yeah, 100%. Somebody could have really different, you know, everyone's got different needs. They might have medical needs that require them to eat. In fact, I had somebody this morning that, you know, they didn't eat before their PT session. And I was like, well, what are you burning then? You know, you're going into your BMR and you're going to be exhausted. There's your body's got to recover. So we have to think of food as fuel. If you're going to go to a really dynamic yoga class, then an hour and a half, maybe a couple of hours before. Obviously, you want to give yourself time to digest.
Yeah.
But you want to make sure you've eaten something of substance so that your body's got fuel to take you through the class. Otherwise, you're going to feel completely depleted afterwards. And maybe, just a light something after class. But again, it depends when you practice. So if you're going to go to an evening class that's quite dynamic, you're not going to want to eat a heavy meal after that.
Yeah.
But if you're going to a yin class in the winter and it's dark, you'll probably want to go home and have some nourishing soup or something. So you could, that is a rabbit hole. Because
I know.
You've got to be, but essentially, you make sure you eat before and after for sure. But just give yourself, as you would if you were going for a swim, you wouldn't have a big dinner and then jump in a swimming pool.
No, be flexible. Know?
So you've got to be flexible.
So moving on to the mind and the benefits of the mind, there are some yoga practices where you don't move at all. Can we assume that these are specifically targeted at the mind, or does all yoga help the mind, whether you recognise it does or it doesn't?
Yeah.
You're thinking you're just going along and moving. Is it automatically helping you? And what about the yoga where you don't move? I mean, some people may have never heard of this.
So are you thinking of like yin yoga?
Yin yoga's very slow, isn't it?
Floor-based, restorative yoga, those kinds of things.
So yoga nidra.
Yoga nidra,
just literally lie there.
It looks like you're sleeping. Yeah, so those practices are very much about, well, all yoga is about that mind-body connection. And ideally what we're aiming for, the objective is to put somebody in the present moment, whether they're moving or not. So if you're in a yin, a restorative, a yoga nidra class, what we're looking at here is going beyond the mind. So we're actually looking at the nervous system.
Right.
So we are looking at how we can keep the mind steady and focused. So giving the mind space, which is hence particularly in yin, why we hold the poses, well, there's various different reasons why we hold poses for long periods of time. But essentially, to start off with the mind, to answer the question, the mind gets given a lot of space in that time. And it might be chattering, and that's fine. We're not asking it to not do that. But yeah, it's very much about slowing the entire system down.
Okay.
Yin in particular is about the connective tissue. So what we're looking at is the pliability of the muscle tissue there. So when we stress the tissue, we're actually adding more hydration back to the tissue when we come back out of the posture. So yin has like a dual effect, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
There's a reason why we hold those poses for so long from a physical level. But a lot of people, I mean, I refer a lot of people to yin if they're super stressed, if they're living in that fight and flight quite often, or if it's a chronic thing where they're just constantly in that fight and flight mode.
It forces you to
forces you to slow down, and it's frustrating. Yeah. It's the hardest practice. I mean, I blend a lot of yin when I teach stress management, because it's the hardest thing for people to do, is to not do. People that can't stop doing find it really difficult not to do. So, and restorative yoga, again, that's about giving the body an opportunity. So that's using props to put people into optimal relaxation positions, where, again, the nervous system is given a chance to ebb and flow back into that rest and digest mode. And yoga nidra is the same, except obviously it's a much more guided practice where somebody will guide you through your entire body. So a body scan. So equally, again, just giving you, giving the mind something to do, but to keep it present.
Yeah.
Rather
so that
than
you're not just drifting
you,
off.
Yeah, or, you're not worrying about tomorrow or thinking about yesterday.
So if we can touch on the brain health there, I've been reading some studies where it's revealed the positive long-term changes that can occur in your brain with regular practice. Mm-hmm. Lengthening your mitochondria. I just can't believe this.
Yeah.
But can yoga increase your brain function?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can it make you smarter?
Well, I don't know. That's not... I am not a neurologist, so it would be very difficult for me to confirm or deny.
But in terms of brain function...
Yeah, brain function, 100%. There's a lot of studies out there now, and yoga has, fortunately, and I've been really lucky to have found yoga medicine 6 years ago. So I've been trained by, neuroscience, well, people that have got neuroscience behind them, or an anaesthetist that was studying the nervous system. Very fortunate to be trained by really well-qualified doctors in this field who have been able to give studies out and share studies that they're familiar with, where so, for example, the practice of mindfulness has been shown to increase the grey matter of
that
the prefrontal
amazing.
Cortex. And that's because if we think about the body, or the internal system is this like neural pathway. So obviously everything we do comes back to the nervous system. So every time I move myself, or every thought I have, that gets processed in my body through this highway. And this again is a huge subject. But if I constantly think in a negative way, my body's going to react in a negative way, because that's what I'm teaching it to do. I am teaching my body, I am stressed, I am worried. So it's releasing that message into my body. So my body goes, right, they're stressed, they're worried. What do we need for that? Adrenaline. We need to make sure they're ready, because they're clearly in danger. So let's put it in really simplistic terms.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine that constant messaging happening, that stress loop happening in the body, there's only one way that can go.
I mean, you can feel it yourself. You're like, the shoulders go up.
Everything.
The muscles are tense.
Exactly. So the muscle tissue is getting a signal, fight or flight, fight or flight. Yeah. So if we start practicing practices whereby we are rewiring that neural pathway and saying to the body, saying to the mind, actually, I'm okay and I'm doing this practice, and you stay focused. So reason why I mentioned mindfulness is because that's all about teaching you to be present. You can actually rewire the brain to become less reactive. So you know yourself, if you're stressed and you're tired and you're anxious, you're probably quite a reactive person. Something that might be insignificant to someone else could be really significant for you, and could cause you to either get quite angry at somebody or get quite upset. On the flip side of that, if you are training your brain, so to speak, to be less reactive, you are going to become less reactive.
Yeah.
And that's what the great part about this is, you know, and where these people have been able, you know, these really, in you know, amazing people have been able to create these studies and really delve deep and actually research this and prove that it does happen. So hence why meditation has become a lot more respected now because of its health benefits and the evidence behind it.
Yeah. Increasing your brain is amazing just by...
Yeah. And as a practitioner, you know, as a meditation, you know, obviously I practice meditation. In fact, picked it up again, something that I dip in and out of. And as a yoga teacher, I know that my practice needs to be much more consistent. And I made a point of that a few weeks ago. And you definitely feel instantly the benefit of doing it. And I've, you know, literally I'm talking 5 minutes here. I'm not saying I've been sitting for an hour, you know, with my mala beads. Absolutely not. I've just, you know, I've had the baby crawling around me at the same time, but just making a point of that 5 minutes. And it really does. You just feel so much more in control of your headspace.
I mean, you can even get apps and things to help you with that now.
Absolutely. I mean, there are other apps available, but I can recommend Headspace so much. I mean, Sleepcast, who the hell invented them? They are genius. Sleepcast. I mean, come on. This is an excellent. I've been literally living off Sleepcast for the last 2 weeks, sending me to sleep. And it is amazing. The benefits of them, you know, if you have trouble falling asleep, and then they've got Sleep SOS. So for me and you, if we wake up in the night, you put the Sleep SOS on and you're back to sleep within 5 or 10 minutes. It's amazing.
I think insomnia is one of the big things lately. But...
I mean, the studies on sleep on their own, I mean, that's a whole different subject. But the importance of sleep, but actually sleep and the mind. And I mean, the lack of sleep has been linked to Parkinson's disease because that part of the brain. So you sort of going back to the original question, can we improve the function of our brain? 100%. And that's an actual researched, that was a study that they did that linked Parkinson's with sleep deprivation because that part of the brain
that's
starts to
so
kind of
interesting.
Die off. Yeah.
So... before we go on to the nervous system, I just wanted to say there, so you can not only increase brain function, but can you rewire the brain? Can you actually make it without consciously saying, oh, I'm going to start doing this? Is it able to be done through meditation?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So, and just the latest course that, well, the latest module that I had to do there for yoga medicine was all about this. And what we were talking about, so we've got this, the primitive part of our brains that we're born with, and they are designed to keep us safe, right? So we will always revert back to them. They're the parts of our brain that know when we're in danger, and they'll be like, oh, we need to do this. But unfortunately, what can happen there is we will constantly revert back to them unless we teach them to do the opposite. So again, if we go back to that fight and flight mode, my primitive brain is always going to keep me protective. It's always going to say, oh, release the adrenaline, get the hormones out there, keep them safe. And I can let myself go into a spiral and behave like that continuously. And that part of my brain will constantly be at the forefront of my behavior.
Yeah.
So if I start doing other practices which teach me to stay calm, to be less reactive, to be more present, that part of the brain will start to get overridden by my more thinking brain.
Right. So just by doing more practice.
Just by being more present and obviously just, evolving that part of the brain through, you know, these things, you can override those primitive parts of the brain, essentially.
So you touched on there the brain, the system. Can we just explain the nervous system? So you touched on the brain... is one system, and the other system is, so the fight and flight one is one system, and the rest and digest is the other. Can you just explain
that? Yeah, so I mean, God, the nervous system is like a big
that
subject.
Is a whole other podcast.
But I think the simplest way to think about this, so we've obviously got our central nervous system, which is the brain and the brainstem and the spinal cord. So if we look at the most common terms people will have heard of is fight and flight and rest and digest. So fight and flight is our sympathetic nervous system. Rest and digest is our parasympathetic nervous system. Now, as we live in this kind of Western world, this modern day world, what we are seeing is more people living in their fight and flight. So that means they're very highly stressed, they're overworked, they're under pressure. And we've lost the ability to ebb and flow between our rest and digest and our fight and flight. So we're living chronically in this fight and flight mode. Back in the day when we were quite, you know, sort of primitive, we would have had fight and flight to protect us from danger. So caveman, threat, cavewoman, threat. I should say cave person.
Cave person.
Threat. they would have the ability to deal with the threat. The threat would have disappeared and they would have gone back to their day to day. And what's happened now is we are constantly living with the threat, whatever that may be. So whether it's stress, whether it's mental health, whatever.
Yeah, so the rest and digest is not getting a
chance. So that rest and digest, that parasympathetic nervous system is kind of being really underutilized, which then means that that's having an effect on our immune function. It's having an effect on our mental health. And obviously now these terms are becoming much more familiar because of they're becoming much more acceptable.
Yeah.
In this day and age, which is a great thing for us.
That's fantastic.
As yoga teachers.
So to combat that, then you need to keep feeding the parasympathetic, the rest and digest.
I mean, stress is good, right? So we need both. It's not like we want to eliminate the fight and flight. We need it because that's what gets you up in the morning. It gets you to work. It gives you motivation to tackle the shoe cupboard or, you know, I really need to sort the garage out.
Yeah.
That's that mode where we need it. The problem is we can live in it in the sense that we're constantly thriving to complete a task, or it's a case of not knowing when to stop and just take a back seat. And also the feeling of guilt. We feel guilty for doing nothing.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're like, I should be doing this.
I've got loads of tasks.
I feel bad that I'm not, you know, I could sit down and have a cup of tea, but I need to empty the washing machine. And we've lost that ability to just sit and do nothing.
Yeah. Life seems to have... goes so fast.
And we've become really busy and demanding on ourselves.
Hard on ourselves.
And having that ability to be able to ebb and flow and knowing actually you've done that task for the day or you've been in that mode or the stress, you know, I need to leave that stress at home or I need to leave that stress at work, wherever it is, and come away from that and give yourself a moment where you can either do, you know, a yoga pose or go for a walk or whatever it is that helps you manage your stress.
So in terms of mindfulness that you mentioned and meditation or even the non-moving yoga or very slow yoga, does that mean that your mind shuts off? Or that is one myth about meditation, that you have to clear your mind and think of nothing or think of one word or whatever.
Empty your mind.
Empty your mind. One. Yes, just
empty
not possible.
Your mind.
The nonsense that's in there, it would take months.
Okay. I don't know if that's actually medically possible to empty your mind. I think, and this comes back down to terminology. There's a lot of like NLP and stuff which talk about that, what you instruct somebody, how you inform them or how you cue them into doing something. So this is the thing. And I've had this argument with somebody before and they were like, mindfulness is completely different to meditation. And I'm like, no, I think you'll find it's a form of meditation. No, but meditation is about emptying your mind. No, it isn't. So we'll just put it out there. No, it isn't. That would be impossible.
Yeah.
And the mind is not there to be emptied. The purpose of it is to clear the chatter from your mind, which means that we put ourselves into a position where we can stay focused on the present moment. Now, that present moment might be you focusing on your hand resting on your lap. Well, you're thinking about that, right? That's a thought. That's a sensation.
That couldn't be clear.
So that couldn't be clear. So it's about trying to engage people and give them the tools whereby they can put their thoughts into an orderly fashion. That's how I like to describe it. And I kind of think of it as a conveyor belt. So as we will, you know, we're laying there or we're sitting there and I'm teaching a meditation, it's almost like think of them as a conveyor belt. So you want to give each one the space, right? So you want to give each thought an acknowledgement to know that it's there. So it might drift in, oh, I need that from M&S. All right, I need that.
Yeah.
You spend a few moments on it and then let it pass. And then you'll find the next thought comes in. But if you can imagine it, that is much more orderly than, I need to do that from M&S. Oh my God, I forgot to pick the ironing up. Oh my God, I've forgotten to put the dog out. So there's like a combination of thoughts that are all happening at the same time. And this is where we get this whole overwhelming feeling from. So meditation and mindfulness is like, well, let's try and see if we can put them thoughts in an order, but then let's also give the mind something to do.
Yeah, I mean, my favourite mindfulness is cooking. I like to follow a recipe, so I'm doing that. You can't do anything else when you're cooking.
Exactly. That's a great example as well, because you have to be so focused.
I mean, I do forget things sometimes, but that's normally when I'm on the phone. Error. But if you're following a recipe or if you've got something on the hob and you're doing something else, mindfulness doesn't have to be sitting down staring into space.
And a busy mind needs, you know, so when we refer to a busy mind, it's this like constant thought process, this loop of like, which breeds worry, which then breeds anxiety, which then breeds, you know, all these other emotions. But what we have to do is give the mind something to do. So if we give it something to do, maybe a breath count, maybe that sensation, maybe it could be ratio breathing. So I want to breathe in for 4 counts, I want to breathe out for 5, depending on what I want to achieve.
At least you're thinking about that. And even if you forget at 3, you'll go back to it.
So for even for those short periods of time, and you know, the more we do something, so the more you do that, the more the brain's got, obviously we've got memory, muscles got memory.
Yeah.
So if you come back to the whole yoga mind body thing, the more we do something, the more our mind and body remember it, right? The more negative things we do to our mind body, they're going to remember it.
Sure. So you touched on anxiety there, and in terms of mental health, yoga, does it help with depression and anxiety? I know they're not linked, but they are part of the same bubble.
Yeah, so
can that help with your...
Yeah, for definite. I think from a personal experience, for me, being very, very young coming into yoga, there was definitely something that gave me self-confidence and gave me the ability to trust myself and my intuition. And obviously depression and anxiety, for whatever reason that people are experiencing it, it's something that only a person who has experienced it can ever understand, because it is very different for everybody who goes through it. But in terms of giving them a peace of mind and a space where they can come and rest their emotional state, rest their mental state, rest their physical being, to come to a point of where they are just in that moment. And that's not going to happen overnight. This is going to be a commitment to something where they can really teach themselves some tools to take them out of those dark days, to take them out of those periods of darkness, to give them the confidence to know that they're not in threat, you know, if we're going from anxiety, you know, and that overriding worry and that anxiousness that they get, which could be at the most simplest thing to some people, but for them it's a huge thing. And I think that's very much misunderstood when it comes to those two things, is that yes, to the lay person that's feeling generally okay, it could be completely insignificant to them, someone else's trouble.
Don't know what's going
you
on.
You just don't know, and
it's
very difficult.
So consistency is key, though. You're saying you don't wake up one day, start doing a 5K and run a marathon. You've got to
It's about management. It's a bit like addiction. It's not something that you get rid of. It's something you live with and you maintain and you manage it. You can definitely, you know, mental health and yoga.
And I know you've dealt with PTSD as well.
Absolutely. You know, it's, and this again comes back to the nervous system. It comes back to that, like you said, this whole rewiring, this neural pathway of changing that prefrontal cortex. So we come with this more sort of rational thinking, as opposed to this more reptilian, this more limbic system, which takes over the protective side of it. So teaching the brain teaching ourselves, you know, new ways, new patterns, new thinking processes, new ways of dealing with life, as opposed to, you know, and obviously medicine's got a place, it definitely has, but you know, there is a suppressant element to that we need to get to the root cause. Yeah. And I think a lot of people that are experiencing depression and anxiety, there's a root cause there that needs to be tapped into. And a consistent practice can help to reveal that sometimes. And which is where, I know we're not touching on this, but just as a side note to anyone who might be listening, that's why it's really, really important that you go to a really well-qualified and highly experienced mindfulness teacher or meditation teacher, because things will come up. Yeah. And you need somebody to be able to deal with that, that hasn't just gone online and become a teacher. And, you know,
I do. I mean, I've experienced that in classes myself.
Yeah, people you've just got to be very
burst into tears.
And, yeah, 100, and it happens in yoga.
Yeah,
definitely. I've had it a lot in yoga classes where somebody will say, "I really don't feel great after that," and it's because, you know, these practices are designed to bring things up. That's why they're so powerful, and why now, in medicine terms, they are so, they've been found to be so beneficial, because they
powerful.
Have this power, you know, and that's through just the body releasing. You know, you'll find people that will have massive stresses and they'll be a practitioner and they'll go to yoga practice and they'll be going through really severe, you know, quite stressful times. The stress will disappear and then all of a sudden they have burnout because the body has just gone, "Oh, thank you.
You've released me from this 10 hours a day practice."
Yeah. And that could be, you know, they might start crying, or, you know, they'll feel a massive big weight, but there'll be this sense of relief. You know, there's also, I've seen all sorts over the, you know, the 20 odd years of it. But no, absolutely. Very powerful. But side note, make sure you do go to a very, you know, to an experience.
Do your research.
Do your research for sure. And if anybody's interested to know who's out there, feel free to get in touch and I can point you in the right direction.
Sure. So I want to touch on something that you literally cannot touch. You can't explain. You can't put it into words, which is your spirit.
Yeah.
Because yoga is mind, body and spirit.
Yeah.
I mean, earlier you clarified that it's not a religion.
Yeah.
But in terms of your spiritual self, without being too existential, will we start to question ourselves? We'll be like, why am I here? Will it turn me into a lovely person? Will I be all chilled?
Absolutely.
Will I be wishing
yourself
peace and love on everybody?
Absolutely.
I mean, what does it do for our spirit?
Yeah. So when we're talking about spirit, I mean, if you go back to the ancient texts, they'll talk about God. But actually what they're saying is it's your perception of your God. So that higher being that you maybe turn to. And we talk about yoga when we look at it. And it was one of the first lessons I taught when I was training some teachers. It's like we have a little self and we have a big self. And I like to refer to it as like this inner sat nav. So what we get, so our spirit is our true being. So this kind of voice, if you can imagine our little self sitting there, and this is your gut instinct, right? So this is the thing that will guide you. Yeah, in your gut, actually.
Literally
in your gut. That will give you, this doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah.
This isn't really what I want to be doing. But quite often and more commonly what we hear now is that people ignore that voice and they will look to their bigger self. So we refer to this as the ego, and that isn't, I mean, the ego, again, is a whole different subject. And we're not talking about walking into a room and thinking you're the bee's knees. That is part of it. But the ego in the sense that this overriding voice will take over and say, shut up.
Because obviously your brain is your practical item. It's,
exactly. So you know,
and you don't want to be doing this. You don't want to be doing this.
And again, it goes back to that kind of safety net, that part of the brain where we look at the safety net and it's like, no, don't do that. That could be quite dangerous. And then that kind of that inner sat nav saying, but really, is it that dangerous?
Yeah.
You know, that's this more rational thinking, but that deep instinct, that real gut instinct that tells you, that guides you. And what yoga is all about is about revealing that and turning, I like to refer to it as turning the volume up on that voice to guide you in a way that is much more honest to yourself. So the best way to explain it is, and I use this all the time, a dinner invitation.
Mm-hmm.
You've been invited out to dinner and you really don't want to go because you would really like to stay at home, put your fluffy socks on, have a drink, get cozy, but you've committed to this dinner and you really don't want to go. So rather than at the invitation point say, do you know what, that night doesn't really work for me. Would you mind if we did it next Friday or whatever? instead you agree to the dinner, the day comes.
You're dreading
it. But you're really dreading it. And you actually go, do you know what? I'm just going to cancel.
CBA.
So you cancel, you go home, then you feel rubbish.
Feel bad.
You feel bad. You feel guilty because you should have just said no at the first instance. Yeah. So then you've created all these other issues that really could have been avoided. And that's really because, you know, and there's a very big difference when I explain it like this. You know, there's avoidance just because you can't be bothered.
Yeah.
And there's a real like, you know what, I need to take care of me that day. I've put that day in as a day for me. I don't really want to compromise that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to actually say no to that invitation and not feel bad about saying no. You know, any decent friend is going to accept it and of say, course. I can't do it. So, yeah, in terms of the spirit, what we're saying is the yoga practice and the coming back to the consistency.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, the more you do, the more you'll get in tune with us.
You will be so fine-tuned in that you will be very confident in all your decisions is what I like to think. And just the way that you live, naturally you will just become a happier and healthier person because you're not distracted by this kind of fear and worry, you know, of day-to-day things.
Yeah, the constant hunched shoulders.
You know, you'll be holding
the drama.
Yourself. Yeah, exactly. You know, and the physical and the mental go hand in hand. If you're mentally burdened, you're physically going to be burdened. You know, you're going to see that quite evidently.
So finally, as yoga is for every single one of us in one form or another, really, if you've never done yoga before, or if even if you have and you weren't sure, can you give us your top tips on finding a yoga that's suitable for you? Because there's yoga out there for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. There really
What's the best way to go about it?
So do your research. Make sure you check your teacher's credentials, particularly if you've got some, if you've got something going on. If you know, if you've been recommended by your GP to go to yoga, make sure if you've got a back problem, for example, you're not going to go into a really dynamic vinyasa class or anything like that that could end up doing you more damage. Speak to the teacher. If you're curious, speak to the teacher. And if you're a real beginner, find a beginner's class and enter into that. Take it slowly and pay no attention to what anyone else is the class that's doing.
Yeah.
Do not
that
be,
is key actually.
Yeah. Pay no attention to anybody else in the class. And hopefully that's confirmed now from what we were saying before about tension in the body and compression
and tension.
Don't
be looking at someone who can do a handstand and
absolutely.
Thinking, oh, look at them.
Yeah.
That is not why you're there.
No, that's not why you're there. And look at why you're going to yoga. So if you're going, so you know, if
if you've got to a point where you're seeking it out, there must be some interest.
Something. So if you know you're really highly stressed and you just want to relax, then you're going to go for a more yin restorative type class. If you want a bit more movement and you're physically able and you're functional, you've got no issues that could be irritated, then try all of them. You know, go for everything and find something that suits you. But if it's very specific, and you've been recommended it because it is for stress or it's for something else, then the much slower paced classes, and any good teacher will be able to advise you in that respect. And if you contact a studio, the studio will be able to inform you what the best class might be for you. So don't be afraid to tell them why you want to do it. You know, and the important thing is yoga, we do not judge.
And any good teacher worth their salt is going to say, this isn't for you.
Absolutely.
What you want is something.
Yeah, absolutely. And they will be, you know, they've got a duty of care and they will definitely make sure, they should make sure that they point you in the right direction.
Oh, God, that is so good. I mean, we could go on and on about the benefits of yoga. I mean, literally, we could go on and on.
Yeah, literally.
But we haven't got time.
And I hope it's all made sense because I feel like I'd be like, blah, blah, blah.
That brings us to the end of today's yoga podcast. I want to thank my guest, Lisa McCabe, for indulging us with all things yogi. Is that the right term? Yoga. You are a yogi.
Yeah.
You've spoke about yoga.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, we won't even break it down.
It doesn't matter. Just enjoy it.
Just go out there and enjoy it. Yeah.
So if you've got any questions, hit me up or you can contact Lisa at omshantiyogaliving.com or Optimal Health for all your yoga needs. Thank you, Lisa.
That concludes today's podcast. If you have any questions, please get in touch. You can find me on the gram at Get Jill Podcasts.